that, we are ready to move to the third matter on our calendar today, and I assume council are here. You can take a seat at the table. While you're doing that, we're also moving our papers around. So when the marshal is ready, you can call the third matter on our oral argument calendar.
Case A19-0412, James M. Erickson, appellant versus Darlene P. Meck, et al., respondents.
All right, and take whatever time you need to get settled into council table. I'll make a few quick remarks. First of all, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. When you do approach the podium, take the time to make whatever adjustments you want to the microphone so that it's right at your mouth and we can hear you, as well as the height of the podium. That will make you more comfortable. And then identify yourself before you begin your remarks, as well as the client that you are here representing. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think the microphone is all right. My name is Kenneth Chavone, and my client, James Erickson, is here today in the courtroom with me. This appeal relates to a summary judgment that was granted by the trial court, and the case involves a claim by a tenant against the landlords resulting from a fall in the bathroom of the leased property. The bathroom floor was made soft by a water leak emanating from the plumbing at the bathtub faucet. Appellant's foot went through the surface of the floor and he fell, receiving injuries to his left foot, right shoulder and elbow, neck and head.
I don't think the district court took issue with the claimed injuries, Mr. Chavone. What the district court's summary judgment motion or order seemed to be based on was the ability to tie the claimed injuries to what happened in light of the pre-existing medical condition of your client. So I think it would be helpful if we could kind of narrow that down, because the court didn't seem to take issue with how it happened, but and initially denied summary judgment, but granted it the second time around as I review the record. So you had doctors evaluate your client, and they couldn't tie any of his claimed symptoms to injuries that he might have sustained in that incident. So that was the basis for the court's summary judgment ruling.
Thank you, Judge Flory. The client's history, is one of having had a crush injury when he was a young man, broke his back when a load of lumber fell off a pallet onto him, and he was not at fault at that. He was injured in an automobile accident, again, that he was not at fault at. There were injuries to his back, not necessarily exactly the same part of the back where he was injured when he fell, but and he was also approaching age 65 at the time of the injury. So he was definitely experiencing the general degeneration that we all experience as we approach old age. So, the opinion of the doctor that we, and we were concerned about this, and although we felt strongly that, irrespective of the presence or absence of expert medical testimony, that the injured person here, Mr. Erickson, was competent to testify as to the fact that he was injured and the fact that those injuries resulted in pain, discomfort, and affected his way of life, his entire being following the accident. And that's the crux, I think, of the issue here, is he competent to testify to these matters?
Now, draw comparisons between his current condition and his pre-existing condition.
Yes, thank you, Judge Albrechts. And so,
but that's what you're saying, that he would be in a position to make that judgment.
And to testify to that effect, yes. So the respondents cited some, a couple of cases, and the trial court took those cases and incorporated them into the opinion. And those two cases did stand for the proposition that expert testimony was required in those cases, and this is a very individualistic situation from case to case. The first case, Anderson versus City of Coon Rapids, talks about injuries to the lungs of the plaintiffs resulting from the escape of nitrous oxide in an ice rink. No layperson could testify to the effects of inhaling nitrous oxide. It's absolutely necessary that there be expert medical testimony. And there was the question of what other alternative causes there might have been. So without expert testimony, there was no way to conclude that. And they also rely on Christensen versus Northern States Power Company in Wisconsin. And there were alternative theories as to what killed the minnows in a minnow farm. And there was blasts, there was weather, there was other potential conditions. And again, it was impossible to pin it down as to what caused those minnows to die. There are injuries that are new to Mr. Erickson's body as a result of the fall. And, there was part of his neck that had not been previously injured, and his shoulders and his arm, particularly his shoulder and his arm. He was a very active person involved in baseball as a player and as an umpire into his age at the time that he lost completely as a consequence of the injuries. And so our request is that he be given an opportunity to testify as to these matters. Appellant cited a Minnesota U.S. District Court case which was in support of the position that expert medical testimony is not necessary. That was in re Baycall Products litigation. And in that case, the court mentioned a number of cases from around the country, including from Minnesota, in which that was a question as to what whether or not expert medical testimony was necessary to prove injury, pain, and suffering, and a change in lifestyle. One of the cases that was cited in Baycall was MMB versus BLG, Minnesota Court of Appeals case from 1991. In that case, the court noted that the plaintiff's expert could not determine that the plaintiff's illness was caused by a recent infection from her partner, or possibly was due to a dormant condition. This involved young people, sex, and herpes. The court stated it is well settled that positive testimony by a medical expert is not necessary in every personal injury action to establish a causal connection between the defendant's negligent act and the plaintiff's injury. The court goes on to state expert testimony is required to establish causation only where the question involves obscure and abstruse medical factors such that the ordinary layman cannot reasonably possess well-founded knowledge of the matter and could only indulge in speculation in making a finding. As causation of herpes is not beyond the average person's knowledge, expert testimony was not necessary to establish causation in this case. MMD's medical experts' inability to determine the recency of the infection to a reasonable medical certainty does not deprive the fact finder of the ability to determine causation in this case. So if MMD is not a case which involves obscure and abstruse medical factors, such that the ordinary layman cannot reasonably possess well-founded knowledge of the matter, how much more common and open to the experience and common sense of a layperson is appellant's case of negligence and injury? That was the main issue in the court's decision. There were two other matters that are involved. One of them was that Mr. Erickson had to have brought his case for some of the problems, some of the other problems that are listed in his complaint, had to have brought this action under Minnesota Statutes 504B.395 at SEC. Nothing in those provisions would suggest that the remedy replaced appellant's common law rights for negligence, and for strict liability for violation of law by failing to fulfill their landlord duties and obligations under MSA 504B.161, which we've strongly identified.
Well, hasn't this court recently published an opinion that said there is no private cause of action under Section 161? And the Supreme Court in the Fritz decision has spoken pretty directly about that same issue. So I'm wondering what the basis is in Minnesota law for that claim of relief that have been brought here, when it seems like both this court and the Supreme Court has spoken to the contrary.
Judge Flory, I'm not familiar with the Fritz case.
It's Weiss.
I'm sorry?
Weiss is the...
Weiss?
Weiss, W-I-S-E.
S-E.
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the case, Your Honor, but I have reviewed this statute closely, and the statute says specifically that it does not replace other rights that exist under the law, including the common law. If that's the very last section of that provision. And, you know, it's not a replacement. It's a remedial statute. The remedy available is there to help somebody who has had a problem with a landlord that the landlord has failed to address that seriously affects their use of the property. And under that, they are given the opportunity to bring an action. That action involves withholding the rent payments, and certainly has some muscle behind it to cause the landlord to take remedial action. And that's a wonderful remedy, but it's not exclusive by its own terms to those kinds of situations. We should note that Mr. Erickson had made an attempt to, on his own, without really being aware of the statute, to withhold rent. He withheld several months' rent, it's in the record, and when he was given a notice from the landlord to pay the rent or leave the premises, he capitulated and paid the overdue rent. And we've also made note of the fact that under the law, the landlord is required to post notice that the Secretary of State has provided information to tenants, lessees of residential property. It is without question that the landlords failed to post that notice, and having failed to post that notice, there is no constructive notice to Mr. Erickson that he has the right to go to the Secretary of State, Department of Commerce, I don't remember which, I think it's the Secretary of State, to get that information, and thereby to become familiar with his rights and obligations as a tenant. He didn't get that opportunity. So anything that happened in respect to his taking that action under the remedial statute, or failing to take that action under the remedial statute, is really obviated by the fact that he just did not have constructive notice that he had rights. The final issue relates to the trial court's dismissing the claim for return of the rent deposit without comment or justification. Under no circumstances would a return of a rental deposit be required to be brought under the remedial statute, because by definition it has to be brought after the end of the tenancy, so he's not there any longer and has to ask for his money back.
I didn't notice in any of the briefing any discussion of the requirements under Chapter 504B regarding return of damage deposits, both the responsibilities of the tenant that's leaving and the responsibilities of the landlord to provide notice in writing while it's why it's being retained. Nobody briefed those issues. I know you raised the issue of as one of your claims for relief, but there was really no discussion in any of the briefing as to the responsibilities under the statute of both sides regarding return or not non-return of a damage deposit. So it's a little hard for us to address that issue.
Well, the Honor, the problem that we faced, and perhaps we should have addressed it more clearly in the briefing, was that the trial court did not address it.
Right.
What we're trying to figure out, counsel, is whether that issue is properly in front of us, because it falls to you as the appellant to identify the issues that we are seeking, and not merely to identify them, but to argue them in your brief.
Well, if the trial court didn't address it in any way, then it should still be part of the suit.
If I understand you right, you're arguing it's a separate claim?
Yes, Your Honor.
Included in your complaint, and it wasn't resolved below?
And it wasn't resolved by the order directly in any way. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Stuart Johnson, and I'm one of the attorneys that represents the respondents, the Clanks, in this matter. And we respectfully request that this court affirm the trial court's decision in its entirety. I briefly want to discuss the factual background because I think it gives us a good play of what's going on here, and I'll be brief in this. August 13, 2008, there's a lease agreement signed and dated. The top of the original release lists Attorney Chavone's name, and the testimony of the Clanks is that Mr. Erickson wanted to go over the lease and have his attorney review it before he had tenancy. This is Index 1 of the trial court record and also found in the Clank deposition. At this time, there was also a joint inspection that was signed by both parties acknowledging the condition of the property, new toilet paint, etc. There's been issues in the complaint about some preliminary sewage issues that undisputedly resolved in May of 2009. That was corrected. That's appellant's brief, page 9, paragraph 1, their reply, page 4, paragraph 1, and our brief, page 5, paragraph 3. These claims fail for other reasons about the sewage backup, but the 6-year statute of limitation would have ran at the latest in May of 2015, a year or more prior to the suit. January 24th, 2014 is the alleged fall. Then there's some written notice to leave the lease or leave the apartment or home with less than 30 days notice. Appellant undisputedly vacates no later than October 24th, 2015 and is no longer a residential tenant under the statute at that point. November 5th, 2015, there's a letter from the City of Lionel Lakes, and it was requested that they wait until after he vacated to send this or when he's no longer a residential tenant. October 19th, 2016 is when the complaint is actually served. The complaint is drafted by counsel, not issued by a court administrator or a judge. No certified copy of the inspection report, which we'll discuss in a little bit. Case is filed with the court in May of 2017. What's in the addendum of the complaint is not the one that was actually served, as there's a court file number on there, and there's some other changes to the language, wording, and some of those counts, but it really is not relevant. The result is the same. So the complaint alleges this personal injury action, and also alleges violations or rights to remedies under 504B.161 and 504B.171. There's some discussions in the brief that that was an error and it's supposed to be 504B.181, but that does not matter as the guidelines are the same. First, the injury claim fails as a matter of law, and we request that you grant or affirm the summary judgment on that count. It doesn't matter how the fall occurred. What's at issue is whether or not he can discuss the causation. And in fact, the undisputed evidence is that there's no evidence of the causal connection between the fall and the alleged injuries. Other than his testimony, there's no medical expert testimony. In fact, to the contrary, there's multiple affidavits stating that medical experts, due to the complex history, can't differentiate between what's alleged after this fall and what was previously there. So on the one hand, the argument is, this is so complex, boy, we can't even get a medical doctor to determine what is different between the two. And then on the same, and then the other breath, it's, well, but this is so simple, it's so ordinary that an ordinary layperson should be able to talk about what the injuries and the harm are. This is not that situation.
Mr. Johnson, when I looked at that, and I appreciate that even as treating physicians seem to have an inability to attribute, causation, but it may not be a strong case, but why is Mr. Erickson not entitled to come into court and try to make the best argument he can to a jury that, there are additional problems he's sustained as a result of this fall? I mean, it may not go anywhere, but...
It gets to the fact of it's just speculation. When there's no medical testimony and there's subjective complaints and a complex medical history, there's no guidance given to a jury. It's just they're left run rampant to speculate when we're not saying, look, we don't have enough evidence to talk about the medical bills, so we'll throw that out. But yet he should still talk about how these injuries are permanent or the nature and extent and how they've impacted his life when no expert opinion will say they're permanent or they're even fact caused by this alleged incident. The standard for a negligence action has always been duty, breach, causation, and damages, and they're missing that causal link between them. And
is your argument expert testimony in a personal injury claim is always needed on the causation claim, or that it's needed in this case because of the particular circumstances that the facts present here?
The latter, Your Honor. In this case, it's not a simple injury, fall, medical treatment, and then harm. There can be circumstances, just not this one. An example would be something where there is no other medical history, something where there is a witness, to the incident itself, and there's some immediacy of medical care that's simply related to that. One of the other factors in this case, on top of the complex medical history, is the fact that there's a significant delay in any treatment. I can certainly see the situation of, an injury, immediate transport, immediate documentation of what those injuries are, that maybe it's not necessary, but that's not what we have here.
So if I understand you right, counsel, you're saying that in this case, if Mr. Erickson had fallen in the bathroom, and let's just assume for the purposes of the argument that that is related to the negligence of the landlord in maintaining the premises, and in that fall had broken his arm and sought immediate treatment for that, he wouldn't necessarily, it's not your position that he would necessarily require medical testimony for that type of injury.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's an objective injury. There's an immediacy of onset. There's an immediacy of treatment. They're not subjective complaints. I mean, some of these, the allegations even in the brief are dizziness, anxiety and depression, numbness, tingling, things that are beyond, haven't had any diagnosis and beyond the lay people to determine. There was some discussion about the cases cited in our brief. Christensen, that case stands for the fact that there's got to be more than just a theory. There's got to be some kind of causal connection between them, that the negligent act didn't just cause it, it couldn't have just caused damage, but did in fact do so. It's got to be something certain, ascertainable. The Anderson case, counsel correctly stated, it is a nitrogen dioxide case involving a Zamboni, But the case, if you look at the discussion of the facts and the discussion of the application, it said it wasn't enough just to assume that because injuries happened afterwards, that that was enough. You have to attribute the symptoms specifically to the incident versus other events. And that's what's missing here, is the ability to attribute the symptoms to the actual alleged incident versus these other discussed events, which is the complex history, the other claims, those things. And that hasn't been done here. The Bakel case, similarly cited by the appellant and addressed in our brief, it was allegations that pain and weakness were found after ingestion of medication. And the court said, that's not enough. You need expert testimony to relate those to the specific ingestion of medication versus some differential diagnosis, examples of other factors that may exist. Similarly, that's what's at issue here, is we have some alleged symptoms, but we don't have any relation or differential diagnosis saying it was but for this incident that you have those symptoms. It wasn't the other factors. And the medical experts, or lack thereof, are clear that they can't determine that. There's some strong words in the affidavit signed by counsel of the inability for medical experts to talk about this. No doctor, this is the first affidavit, November 13, 2018. It's index 75 at paragraph 14. A doctor was unable to separate the effects of the current injury from a crush injury to the lower back he sustained as a young man and later in a rear-end automobile accident. The second affidavit submitted without expert testimony is even stronger. This is January 11, 2019, index 96, paragraphs 2 and 3. Paragraph 2, that it was unable to deliver a medical opinion, reasonable certainty that the current treatments were caused by the injury in the defendant's property. Those who spoke with me could not provide such opinion. The next paragraph goes on to say, it would not be possible to separate the injuries from which plaintiff has been treated. So you've got medical experts that are trained and they're unable to determine what symptoms, if any, are related to this alleged incident versus his complex medical history. For these reasons, plaintiff simply cannot maintain his burden of proof on that essential element of causation for his alleged injuries to this incident. And without that causal relationship, the trial court got it right, that he's unable to meet the burden and sustain summary judgment on those grounds, and we request that you affirm that. This is not an uncomplicated case of injuries as the example of the broken arm. This is a complex allegations of harm and allegations of treatment that certainly there needs to be something or some guidance of medical expert testimony on. And if the argument is, well, geez, we want to abandon the medical bill claims because we can't relate those, but yet we want to relate some perceived harm of permanency or something like that, that's unsustainable as well, and we request that you affirm. The remainder of the claims in the complaint, for the most part, are made under 504B, and the definition section of that statute, 504B.001 sub 12, is a residential tenant. And a residential tenant is specifically defined in the statute as a person who is occupying. And in order to maintain those claims, it's clear that it has to be a current occupant. The legislature is given meaning to the words it chose, and it says, is occupying. It's not past tense. It could have been easily occupied, former occupant, was occupying. It's clear that it was a current occupant. And there's probably reasons for that. They are there to protect current tenants, to get the landlord and tenant to work together to work out some of these issues, to prevent somebody from just being out on the street. And then there's specific notice requirements for that, too, that clearly aren't yet met here. The residential tenant has been determined and expanded slightly by the Minnesota Supreme Court, and that's the Cotterella v. Driggs case that's cited in the trial court's order. It goes on to give the effect to the words of the statute to say current or occupant means is occupying for residential tenant. And then it expands it slightly and says, or has the present right to occupy. In that case, there was a agreement or a lease agreement, a damage deposit, and there was some moving target of when the person was going to move in that kept on getting moved around. And the court said, well, you've got a present possessory right that should be enough as well. We have to preserve the present legislative intent on the is occupying. It's undisputed, as the trial court repeatedly points out, that Mr. Erickson was not a current tenant when he commenced this action, and in fact hadn't been a tenant of the property for more than a year. On top of those deficiencies, there was failure to comply with the strict statutory terms of 504B.395 for the recovery of the allegations in the complaint, which was citations to 504B.161 and 504B.171. It's clear under 395 that it must be brought by a residential tenant, which Mr. Erickson was not. There must be a summons and complaint issued by a judge or court administrator. It was not. It was clear from the record and what's before you that the only complaint in this case was drafted by Mr. Chavone. There has to be an affidavit or a certified copy of the inspection report accompanying, which is not done. And it's only a trial or a determination by a judge, no jury trial either. It's clear that the applicant fails to meet, or appellant fails to meet, the statutory definitions, and the trial court correctly determined that as well.
So what?
Go right ahead, Judge Foy.
This is a minor issue in this case, but it's an unaddressed issue by virtually everyone, and that's this damage deposit thing that's hanging out there that was pled in the complaint, and no one has really addressed. I couldn't tell you how much the damage deposit is, but it really hasn't been addressed from anybody's perspective, and the district court didn't address it. So what is your thoughts on how we address that issue?
Sure. Well, one, it wasn't raised by the appellant. Two, I can say the damage deposit, my belief, was $500. There was not adherence to the 30-day written notice as required under the statute prior to vacation. And in addition, within the statutory guidelines, the three-week period, my clients did send a letter indicating that they were withholding the damage deposit based on notice and based on the condition of the property. So that was addressed in the materials that were before the trial court of the timing and the request back, and noted that it was within the time frames. In short, Your Honor, we request that the Court of Appeals affirm the district court's decision and grant a summary judgment in its entirety. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel. And appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The fact that, and I guess this, you know, we haven't really addressed this whole issue of what happened and the negligence, which I guess has taken us as correct, but what happened was that he fell down. And there's no speculation as to the fact that he fell down as a consequence of the neglect of the landlord. And there's no dispute that he's entitled to testify that he fell down and he felt pain, and that some of that pain continues, and that he has affected lifestyle changes as a consequence of that. Everything else after that and other than that goes to the weight and sufficiency of the evidence, does it not? He is entitled to testify to these matters. Once again, Section 395 et sec of 504B, it's a remedial statute. It's not a statute, and it's by its terms, it is a remedial statute. By its terms, to allow a tenant while in possession of the property to get some relief from acts or omissions of the landlord. And that's all that it is. And by its terms, it says that it's not intended to replace anything else. And I can't address the Wise case because I haven't seen it as of yet. I was concerned from the get-go that expert medical testimony was going to be a problem for us based on previous injuries and based on age and general, you know, deterioration that we all experience. And I was prepared at some point in time to make a motion to amend the complaint to drop those if we couldn't get that kind of corroboration. A medical expert would get on the stand, for example, and show us an X-ray and show us that the X-ray demonstrates damage to the person. And that is a whole different category of claim and damages as the pain and suffering and change of lifestyle argument. They're completely different and completely separate. But given that we couldn't prove it, I made a motion to amend the complaint to take care of that issue. I did not wish to make serial motions to the court. And so as soon as I knew that we didn't have the medical testimony, I made a motion to amend the complaint, which was not heard and essentially was scheduled at the same time as the court issued the summary judgment order. So it hasn't been addressed. If a plaintiff has the right to bring his case to court, which we say he does, then he has the right under the law to make a motion to amend the complaint. Those motions are generally freely granted in the interests of justice. And at this point, Mr. Erickson would wish, if the court does overturn the summary judgment order, that he be given the opportunity to make his motion to amend the complaint. And that would include the obvious dropping of the medical testimony and those claims related to surgeries and what have you, and to go with what he has. And we'd also want to correct the complaint in respect to the failure to specifically allege Section 181 in respect to the failure of notice. We didn't know when the complaint was drawn that the landlord had failed to give that notice under the law, as required by law. And therefore, when we did, we found out in the taking of the deposition of Mr. Klenk that he did not, in fact, post notice. And this was in July of last year. And so as part of our motion to amend, we're going to ask that be specifically addressed. Although I'm not altogether certain, arguably, it doesn't need to be specifically addressed to be presented to the court in the trial of the case. And so that's what we're asking for, is reversal and direction to the court to allow a motion to amend. Therefore, on behalf of myself and my client, I thank the court for consideration of this matter.
Thank you, counsel. Our thanks to both counsel. This matter has been well briefed and well argued. It is now submitted to the court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So our thanks with that. We have completed our oral argument calendar, and we will recess for our non-oral calendar.